Recorded Books and RB Digital present When He Was Wicked by Julia Quinn. Narrated by Rosalind Landor. Part 1. March, 1820. London, England. Chapter 1.
I wouldn't call it a jolly good time, but it's not as bad as that. There are women, after all, and where there are women, I'm bound to make merry.
From Michael Stirling to his cousin, John, the Earl of Kilmartin. Posted from the 52nd Foot Guards during the Napoleonic Wars. In every life there is a turning point. A moment so tremendous, so sharp and clear, that one feels as if one's been hit in the chest, all the breath knocked out, and one knows, absolutely knows, without the merest hint of a shadow of a doubt, that one's life will never be the same. For Michael Stirling, that moment came the first time he laid eyes on Francesca Bridgerton. After a lifetime of chasing women, of smiling slyly as they chased him, of allowing himself to be caught, and then turning the tables until he was the victor, of caressing and kissing and making love to them, but never actually allowing his heart to become engaged, he took one look at Francesca Bridgerton and fell so fast and so hard into love, it was a wonder he managed to remain standing. Unfortunately for Michael, however, Francesca's surname was to remain Bridgerton a mere 36 hours longer. The occasion of their meeting was, lamentably, a supper celebrating her imminent wedding to his cousin. Life was ironic that way, Michael liked to think, in his more polite moods. In his less polite moods, he used a different adjective entirely. And his moods, since falling in love with his first cousin's wife, were not often polite. Oh, he hid it well. It wouldn't do to be visibly out of sorts. Then some annoyingly perceptive soul might actually take notice, and, God forbid, inquire as to his welfare. And while Michael Stirling held a not unsubstantiated pride in his ability to dissemble and deceive, he had, after all, seduced more women than anyone cared to count, and had somehow managed to do it all without ever once being challenged to a duel. Well, the sodding truth of it was that he'd never been in love before, and if ever there was a time that a man might lose his ability to maintain a facade under direct questioning, this was probably it. And so he laughed, and was very merry, and he continued to seduce women, trying not to notice that he tended to close his eyes when he had them in bed, and he stopped going to church entirely because there seemed no point now in even contemplating prayer for his soul. Besides, the parish church near Kilmartin dated to 1432, and the crumbling stones certainly couldn't take a direct strike of lightning. And if God ever wanted to smite a sinner, he couldn't do better than Michael Stirling. Michael Stirling. Sinner. He could see it on a calling card. He'd have had it printed up, even. His was just that sort of black sense of humour, if he weren't convinced it would kill his mother on the spot. Rake he might be, but there was no need to torture the woman who'd borne him. Funny how he'd never seen all those other women as a sin. He still didn't. They'd all been willing, of course. You couldn't seduce an unwilling woman, at least not if you took seduction at the true sense of the word, and took care not to confuse it with rape. They had to actually want it, and if they didn't, if Michael sensed even a hint of unease, he turned and walked away. His passions were never so out of control that he couldn't manage a quick and decisive departure. And besides, he'd never seduced a virgin, and he'd never slept with a married woman. Oh, very well. One ought to remain true to oneself, even while living a lie. He'd slept with married women, plenty of them, but only the ones whose husbands were rotters, and even then, not unless she'd already produced 2 male offspring. 3, if one of the boys seemed a little sickly. A man had to have rules of conduct, after all. But this was beyond the pale, entirely unacceptable. This was the one transgression, and he'd had many, that was finally going to blacken his soul, or at the very least, and this was assuming he maintained the strength never to act upon his desires, make it a rather deep shade of charcoal. Because this... He coveted his cousin's wife. He coveted John's wife. John. John, who, damn it all, was more of a brother to him than one of his own could ever have been. John, whose family had taken him in when his father had died. John, whose father had raised him and taught him to be a man. John, with whom... Oh, bloody hell! Did he really need to do this to himself? He could spend a se'nnight cataloguing all the reasons why he was going straight to hell for having chosen John's wife with whom to fall in love. And none of it was ever going to change one simple fact. He couldn't have her. He could never have Francesca Bridgerton Sterling. But, he thought with a snort, as he slouched into the sofa and propped his ankle over his knee, watching them across their drawing-room, laughing and smiling, and making nauseating eyes at each other, he could have another drink. "I think I will," he announced, downing it in one gulp. "What was that, Michael?" John asked, his hearing superb, as always, damn it. Michael produced an excellent forgery of a smile and lifted his glass aloft. "Just thirsty," he said, maintaining the perfect picture of a bon vivant. They were at Kilmartin House, in London, as opposed to Kilmartin, no house, no castle, just Kilmartin, up in Scotland, where the boys had grown up, or the other Kilmartin House in Edinburgh. Not a creative soul among his forebears, Michael had often reflected. There was also a Kilmartin cottage, if one could call 22 rooms a cottage, Kilmartin Abbey, and, of course, Kilmartin Hall. Michael had no idea why no one had thought to offer their surname to one of the residences. Stirling House had a perfectly respectful ring to it, in his opinion. He supposed that the ambitious and unimaginative Stirlings of old had been so damned besotted with their newfound earldom that they couldn't think to put any other name on anything. He snorted into his glass of whiskey. It was a wonder he didn't drink Kilmartin tea and sit on a Kilmartin-style chair. In fact, he probably would be doing just that if his grandmother had found a way to manage it without actually taking the family into trade. The old martinet had been so proud, one would have thought she'd been born a Stirling, rather than simply married into the name. As far as she'd been concerned, the Countess of Kilmartin herself was just as important as any loftier personage, and she'd more than once sniffed her displeasure when being led into supper after an upstart marchioness or duchess. The Queen, Michael thought dispassionately. He supposed his grandmother had knelt before the Queen, but he certainly couldn't imagine her offering deference to any other female. She would have approved of Francesca Bridgerton. Grandmother Stirling would surely have turned her nose up upon learning that Francesca's father was a mere viscount, but the Bridgertons were an old and immensely popular, and, when the fancy took them, powerful family. Plus, Francesca's spine was straight, and her manner was proud, and her sense of humour was sly and subversive. If she'd been 50 years older, and not nearly so attractive, she would have made quite a fine companion for Grandmother Stirling. And now Francesca was the Countess of Kilmartin, married to his cousin John, who was 1 year his junior, but in the Stirling household, always treated with the deference due the elder. He was the heir, after all. Their fathers had been twins, but John's had entered the world 7 minutes before Michael's. The most critical 7 minutes in Michael Stirling's life. And he hadn't even been alive for them.
"What shall we do for our second anniversary?" Francesca asked, as she crossed the room and seated herself at the pianoforte.
"Whatever you want," John answered.
Francesca turned to Michael, her eyes startlingly blue, even in the candlelight. Or maybe it was just that he knew how blue they were. He seemed to dream in blue these days. Francesca blue, the colour ought to be called.
Michael, she said, her tone indicating that the word was a repetition.
Sorry, he said, offering her the lopsided smile he so frequently affixed to his face. No one ever took him seriously when he smiled like that, which was, of course, the point. Wasn't listening.
Do you have any ideas? She asked.
For what?
For our anniversary.
If she'd had an arrow, she couldn't have jammed it into his heart any harder. But he just shrugged, since he was appallingly good at faking it. It's not my anniversary, he reminded her.
I know, she said.
He wasn't looking at her, but she sounded like she rolled her eyes. But she hadn't. Michael was certain of that. He'd come to know Francesca agonizingly well in the past 2 years, and he knew she didn't roll her eyes. When she was feeling sarcastic, or ironic, or sly, it was all there in her voice and the curious tip of her mouth. She didn't need to roll her eyes. She just looked at you with that direct stare, her lips curving ever so slightly, and... Michael swallowed reflexively, then covered it with a sip of his drink. It didn't really speak well of him that he'd spent so much time analysing the curve of his cousin's wife's lips.
I assure you, Francesca continued, idly trailing the pads of her fingertips along the surface of the piano keys without actually pressing any into sound, I'm well aware of whom I married.
I'm sure you are, he muttered.
Beg pardon?
Continue, he said, her lips pursed in a peevish crease. He'd seen her with that expression quite frequently, usually in her dealings with her brothers.
I was asking your advice, she said, because you are so often merry.
I'm so often merry, he repeated, knowing that was how the world saw him. They called him the merry rake, after all, but hating the word on her lips, it made him feel frivolous, without substance. And then he felt even worse, because it was probably true.
You disagree? She inquired.
Of course not, he murmured. I'm simply unused to being asked for advice regarding anniversary celebrations, as it is clear I have no talent for marriage.
That's not clear at all, she said.
You're in for it now, John said with a chuckle, settling back in his seat with that morning's copy of the Times.
You have never tried marriage, Francesca pointed out. How could you possibly know you have no talent for it?
Michael managed a smirk. I think it's fairly clear to all who know me. Besides, what need have I? I have no title, no property. You have property, John interjected, demonstrating that he was still listening from behind his newspaper. Only a small bit of property, Michael corrected, which I am more than happy to leave for your children, since it was given to me by John anyway. Francesca looked at her husband, and Michael knew exactly what she was thinking. That John had given him the property because John wanted him to feel he had something, a purpose, really. Michael had been at loose ends since decommissioning from the army several years back, and although John had never said so, Michael knew that he felt guilty for having not fought for England on the continent, for remaining behind while Michael faced danger alone. But John had been heir to an earldom. He had a duty to marry, be fruitful and multiply. No one had expected him to go to war. Michael had often wondered if the property, a rather lovely and comfortable manor house with 20 acres, was John's form of penance. And he rather suspected that Francesca wondered the same. But she would never ask. Francesca understood men with remarkable clarity, probably from growing up with all of those brothers. Francesca knew exactly what not to ask a man, which always left Michael a little worried. He thought he hid his feelings well, but what if she knew? She would never speak of it, of course, never even allude to it. He rather suspected they were, ironically, alike that way. If Francesca suspected he was in love with her, she would never alter her manner in any way.
I think you should go to Kilmartin,
Michael said abruptly.
To Scotland?
Francesca asked, pressing gently against B-flat on the pianoforte.
With the season so close.
Michael stood, suddenly rather eager to depart. He shouldn't have come over in any case. Why not? He asked, his tone careless. You love it there. John loves it there. It's not such a long journey if your carriage is well sprung. Will you come? John asked. I think not, Michael said sharply, as if he cared to witness their anniversary celebration. Truly, all it would do was remind him of what he could never have, which would then remind him of the guilt, or amplify it. Reminders were rather unnecessary. He lived with it every day. Thou shalt not covet thy cousin's wife. Moses must have forgotten to write that one down. I have much to do here, Michael said.
You do?
Francesca asked, her eyes lighting with interest.
What?
Oh, you know, he said wryly. All those things I have to do to prepare for a life of dissolution and aimlessness. Francesca stood.
Oh, God. She stood, and she was walking to him.
This was the worst, when she actually touched him. She laid her hand on his upper arm. Michael did his best not to flinch.
I wish you wouldn't speak that way, she said.
Michael looked past her shoulder to John, who had raised his newspaper just high enough so that he could pretend he wasn't listening. Am I to become your project, then? Michael asked, a bit unkindly. She drew back.
We care about you.
We. We. Not I. Not John. We. A subtle reminder that they were a unit. John and Francesca. Lord and Lady Kilmartin. She hadn't meant it that way, of course, but it was how he heard it all the same. And I care for you, Michael said, waiting for a plague of locusts to stream through the room.
I know, she said, oblivious to his distress. I could never ask for a better cousin, but I want you to be happy.
Michael glanced over at John, giving him a look that clearly said, Save me. John gave up his pretense of reading and set the paper down. Francesca, darling, Michael is a grown man. He'll find his happiness as he sees fit. When he sees fit. Francesca's lips pursed, and Michael could tell she was irritated. She didn't like to be thwarted, and she certainly did not enjoy admitting that she might not be able to arrange her world and the people inhabiting it to her satisfaction.
I should introduce you to my sister, she said.
Good God. I've met your sister, Michael said quickly. All of them, in fact. Even the one still in leading strings.
She's not in...
She cut herself off, grinding her teeth together.
I grant you that Hyacinth is not suitable, but Eloise is...
I'm not marrying Eloise, Michael said sharply.
I didn't say you had to marry her, Francesca said. Just dance with her once or twice.
I've done so, he reminded her, and that is all I am going to do.
But...
Francesca, John said. His voice was gentle, but his meaning was clear. Stop. Michael could have kissed him for his interference. John, of course, just thought that he was saving his cousin from needless, feminine nagging. There was no way he could know the truth. That Michael was trying to compute the level of guilt one might feel for being in love with one's cousin's wife and one's wife's sister. Good God! Married to Eloise Bridgerton! Was Francesca trying to kill him?
We should all go for a walk,
Francesca said suddenly. Michael glanced out the window. All vestiges of daylight had left the sky. Isn't it a bit late for that? He asked.
Not with two strong men as escorts, she said. And besides, the streets in Mayfair are well lit. We shall be perfectly safe.
She turned to her husband.
What do you say, darling?
I have an appointment this evening, John said, consulting his pocket watch. But you should go with Michael. More proof that John had no idea of Michael's feelings. The two of you always have such a fine time together, John added. Francesca turned to Michael and smiled, worming her way another inch into his heart.
"Will you?"
she asked.
"I'm desperate for a spot of fresh air, now that the rain has stopped. And I've been feeling rather odd all day, I must say."
"Of course," Michael replied, since they all knew that he had no appointments. His was a life of carefully cultivated dissolution. Besides, he couldn't resist her. He knew he should stay away, knew he should never allow himself to be alone in her company. He would never act upon his desires, but truly, did he really need to subject himself to this sort of agony? He'd just end the day alone in bed, racked by guilt and desire in almost equal measures. But when she smiled at him, he couldn't say no, and he certainly wasn't strong enough to deny himself an hour in her presence, because her presence was all he was ever going to get. There would never be a kiss, never a meaningful glance or touch. There would be no whispered words of love, no moans of passion. All he could have was her smile and her company. And, pathetic idiot that he was willing to take it.
"Just give me a moment," she said, pausing in the doorway. "I need to get my coat."
"Be quick about it," John said. "It's already after 7.
"I'll be safe enough with Michael to protect me,"
she said with a jaunty smile.
"But don't worry, I'll be quick."
And then she offered her husband a wicked smile.
"I'm always quick."
Michael averted his eyes as his cousin actually blushed. Lord above, but he truly did not want to know the meaning behind "I'll be quick." Unfortunately, it could have been any number of things, all of them deliciously sexual, and he was likely to spend the next hour cataloguing them all in his mind, imagining them being done to him. He tugged at his cravat. Maybe he could get out of this jaunt with Francesca. Maybe he could go home and draw a cold bath, or better yet, find himself a willing woman with long chestnut hair, and if he was lucky, blue eyes as well.
"I'm sorry about that," John said,
once Francesca had left. Michael's eyes flew to his face. Surely John would never mention Francesca's innuendo.
"Her nagging," John added. "You're young enough. You don't need to be married yet." "You're younger than I," Michael said, mostly to be contrary. "Yes, but I met Francesca."
John shrugged helplessly, as if that ought to be explanation enough. And of course it was.
"I don't mind her nagging," Michael said. "Of course you do. I can see it in your eyes."
And that was the problem. John could see it in his eyes. There was no one in the world who knew him better. If something was bothering him, John would always be able to tell. The miracle was that John didn't realize why Michael was distressed.
"I will tell her to leave you alone," John said, "although you should know that she only nags because she loves you."
Michael managed a tight smile. He certainly couldn't manage words.
"Thank you for taking her for a walk,"
John said, standing up. "She's been a bit peckish all day, with the rain. Said she's been feeling uncommonly closed in."
"When is your appointment?" Michael asked.
9 o'clock, John replied, as they walked out into the hall.
"I'm meeting Lord Liverpool." "Parliamentary business?"
John nodded. He took his position in the House of Lords very seriously. Michael had often wondered if he'd have approached the duty with as much gravity had he been born a lord. Probably not. But then again, it didn't much matter, did it? Michael watched as John rubbed his left temple.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
"You look a little..." He didn't finish the sentence, since he wasn't quite certain how John looked. Not right, that was all he knew. And he knew John, inside and out, probably better than Francesca did.
"Devil of a headache," John muttered. "I've had it all day." "Do you want me to call for some laudanum?"
John shook his head.
"Hate the stuff. It makes my mind fuzzy, and I need my wits about me for the meeting with Liverpool."
Michael nodded. "You look pale," he said. Why, he didn't know. It wasn't as if it was going to change John's mind about the laudanum. "Do I?" John asked, wincing as he pressed his fingers harder into the skin of his temple. "I think I'll lie down, if you don't mind. I don't need to leave for an hour." "Right," Michael murmured. "Do you want me to have someone wake you?" John shook his head. "I'll ask my valet myself." Just then, Francesca descended the stairs, wrapped in a long velvet cloak of midnight blue.
"Good evening, gentlemen,"
she said, clearly basking in the undivided male attention. But as she reached the bottom, she frowned.
"Is something wrong, darling?"
she asked John.
"Just a headache," John said. "It's nothing."
"You should lie down," she said.
John managed a smile.
"I'd just finished telling Michael that I was planning to do that very thing. I'll have Simons wake me in time for my meeting."
"With Lord Liverpool?"
Francesca queried.
"Yes, at 9.
"Is it about the 6 acts?
John nodded.
"Yes, and the return to the gold standard. I told you about it at breakfast, if you recall."
"Make sure you..."
She stopped, smiling as she shook her head.
"Well, you know how I feel."
John smiled, then leaned down and dropped a tender kiss on her lips.
"I always know how you feel, darling."
Michael pretended to look the other way.
"Not always,"
she said, her voice warm and teasing.
"Always when it matters," John said.
"Well, that is true,"
she admitted.
"So much for my attempts to be a lady of mystery."
He kissed her again.
"I prefer you as an open book myself."
Michael cleared his throat. This shouldn't be so difficult. It wasn't as if John and Francesca were acting any differently than was normal. They were, as so much of society had commented, like two peas in a pod, marvellously in accord and splendidly in love.
"It's growing late," Francesca said. "I should go if I want that spot of fresh air."
John nodded, closing his eyes for a moment.
"Are you sure you're well?"
"I'm fine," he said. "Just a headache."
Francesca looped her hand into the crook of Michael's elbow.
"Be sure to take some laudanum when you return from your meeting,"
she said, over her shoulder, once they'd reached the door.
"Since I know you won't do it now."
John nodded, his expression weary, then headed up the stairs.
"Poor John,"
Francesca said, stepping outside into the brisk night air. She took a deep inhale, then let out a sigh.
"I detest headaches. They always seem to lay me especially low."
"Never get them myself,"
Michael admitted, leading her down the steps to the pavement.
"Really?"
She looked up at him, one corner of her mouth quirking in that achingly familiar way.
"Lucky you."
It almost made Michael laugh. Here he was, strolling through the night with the woman he loved. Lucky him.
Chapter 2.
"And if it were as bad as that, I suspect you would not tell me. As for the women, do at least try to make sure they are clean and free of disease. Beyond that, do what you must to make your time bearable. And please, try not to get yourself killed. At the risk of sounding maudlin, I don't know what I would do without you."
From the Earl of Kilmartin to his cousin, Michael Stirling, sent in care of the 52nd Foot Guards during the Napoleonic Wars. For all his faults, and Francesca was willing to allow that Michael Stirling had many, he really was the dearest man. He was a horrible flirt. She'd seen him in action, and even she had to admit that otherwise intelligent women lost all measure of sense when he chose to be charming, and he certainly didn't approach his life with the gravity that she and John would have liked him to. But even with all that, she couldn't help but love him. He was the best friend John had ever had, until he'd married her, of course, and over the last 2 years he'd become her close confidant as well. It was a funny thing, that. Who would have thought she'd have counted a man as one of her closest friends? She was not uncomfortable around men. Four brothers tended to wring the delicacy out of even the most feminine of creatures. But she was not like her sisters. Daphne and Eloise, and Hyacinth too, she supposed, although she was still a bit young to know for sure, were so open and sunny. They were the sorts of females who excelled at hunting and shooting, the kinds of pursuits that tended to get them labelled as jolly good sports. Men always felt comfortable in their presence, and the feeling was, Francesca had observed, entirely mutual. But she was different. She'd always felt a little different from the rest of her family. She loved them fiercely, and would have laid down her life for any one of them. But even though she looked like a Bridgerton, on the inside she always felt like a bit of a changeling. Where the rest of her family was outgoing, she was not shy precisely, but a bit more reserved, more careful with her words. She'd developed a reputation for irony and wit, and she had to admit she could rarely resist the opportunity to needle her siblings with a dry remark. It was done out of love, of course, and perhaps a touch of the desperation that comes from having spent far too much time with one's family, but they teased Francesca right back, so all was fair. It was the way of her family. They laughed, they teased, they bickered. Francesca's contributions to the din were simply a touch quieter than the rest, a bit more sly and subversive. She often wondered if part of her attraction to John had been the simple fact that he removed her from the chaos that was so often the Bridgerton household. Not that she didn't love him. She did. She adored him with every last breath in her body. He was her kindred spirit, so like her in so many ways. But it had, in a strange sort of fashion, been a relief to exit her mother's home, to escape to a more serene existence with John, whose sense of humour was precisely like hers. He understood her. He anticipated her. He completed her. It had been the oddest sensation when she'd met him, almost as if she were a jagged puzzle piece, finally finding its mate. Their first meeting hadn't been one of overwhelming love or passion, but rather filled with the most bizarre sense that she'd finally found the one person with whom she could completely be herself. It had been instant. It had been sudden. She couldn't remember just what it was he'd said to her, but from the moment words first left his lips, she had felt at home. And with him had come Michael, his cousin. Although, truth be told, the two men were much more like brothers. They'd been raised together, and they were so close in age that they'd shared everything. Well, almost everything. John was the heir to an earldom, and Michael was just his cousin, and so it was only natural that the two boys would not be treated quite the same. But from what Francesca had heard, and from what she knew of the Stirling family now, they had been loved in equal measure. And she rather thought that was the key to Michael's good humour. Because even though John had inherited the title, and the wealth, and, well, everything, Michael didn't seem to envy him. He didn't envy him. It was amazing to her. He'd been raised as John's brother, John's older brother even, and yet he'd never once begrudged John any of his blessings. And it was for that reason that Francesca loved him best. Michael would surely scoff if she tried to praise him for it, and she was quite certain that he would point to his many misdeeds, none of which, she feared, were exaggerated, to prove that his soul was black, and he was a scoundrel through and through. But the truth of the matter was that Michael Stirling possessed a generosity of spirit and a capability for love that was unmatched among men. And if she didn't find a wife for him soon, she was going to go mad. "What?" she said, aware that her voice was quite suddenly piercing the silence of the night. "Is wrong with my sister?"
"Francesca," he said, and she could hear irritation, and thankfully a bit of amusement as well in his voice. "I'm not going to marry your sister."
"I didn't say you had to marry her."
You didn't have to. Your face is an open book. She looked up at him, twisting her lips.
You weren't even looking at me.
Of course I was. And anyway, it wouldn't matter if I weren't. I know what you're about.
He was right, and it scared her. Sometimes she worried that he understood her as well as John did.
You need a wife, she said.
Didn't you just promise your husband that you would stop pestering me about this?
I did not, actually,
she said, giving him a rather superior glance.
He asked, of course.
Of course,
Michael muttered.
She laughed. He could always make her laugh. I thought wives were supposed to accede to their husband's wishes,
Michael said, quirking his right brow.
In fact, I'm quite certain it's right there in the marriage vows.
I'd be doing you a grave disservice if I found you a wife like that,
she said, punctuating the sentiment with a well-timed and extremely disdainful snort. He turned and gazed down at her with a vaguely paternalistic expression. He should have been a nobleman, Francesca thought. He was far too irresponsible for the duties of a title. But when he looked at a person like that, all superciliousness and certitude, he might as well have been a royal duke.
Your responsibilities as Countess of Kilmartin do not include finding me a wife, he said.
They should.
He laughed, which delighted her. She could always make him laugh.
Very well,
she said, giving up for now.
Tell me about something wicked, then. Something John would not approve of.
It was a game they played, even in John's presence, although John always made at least the pretense of discouraging them. But Francesca suspected that John enjoyed Michael's tales as much as she did. Once he'd finished with his obligatory admonitions, he was always all ears. Not that Michael ever told them much. He was far too discreet for that. But he dropped hints and innuendo, and Francesca and John were always thoroughly entertained. They wouldn't trade their wedded bliss for anything. But who didn't like to be regaled with tales of debauchery and spice?
I'm afraid I've done nothing wicked this week,
Michael said, steering her around the corner to King Street.
You? Impossible.
It's only Tuesday, he reminded her.
Yes, but not counting Sunday, which I'm sure you would not desecrate.
She shot him a look that said she was quite certain he'd already sinned in every way possible, Sunday or no.
That does leave you Monday, and a man can do quite a bit on a Monday.
Not this man. Not this Monday.
What did you do then?
He thought about that. Then said,
nothing really.
That's impossible, she teased. I'm quite certain I saw you awake for at least an hour.
He didn't say anything, and then he shrugged in a way she found oddly disturbing and said,
I did nothing. I walked, I spoke, I ate, but at the end of the day there was nothing.
Francesca impulsively squeezed his arm.
"We shall have to find you something,"
she said softly. He turned and looked at her, his strange silvery eyes catching hers with an intensity she knew he didn't often allow to rise to the fore. And then it was gone, and he was himself again, except she suspected that Michael Stirling wasn't at all the man he wished people to believe him to be. Even sometimes, her.
We should return home, he said. It's growing late, and John will have my head if I let you catch a chill.
John would blame me for my foolishness, and well you know it, Francesca said. This is just your way of telling me you have a woman waiting for you, probably draped in nothing but the sheets on her bed.
He turned to her and grinned. It was wicked and devilish, and she understood why half the ton, the female half, that was, fancied themselves in love with him, even with no title or fortune to his name.
You said you wanted something wicked, didn't you?
He asked.
Did you want more detail? The colour of the sheets, perhaps?
She blushed, drat it all. She hated that she blushed, but at least the reaction was covered by the night.
"Not yellow, I hope,"
she said, because she couldn't bear to let the conversation end on her embarrassment.
"It makes you look sallow."
"I won't be wearing the sheets," he drawled.
"Nevertheless,"
he chuckled, and she knew that he knew that she'd said it just to have the last word, and she thought he was going to allow her the small victory. But then, just when she was beginning to find relief in the silence, he said, "Red."
"I beg your pardon?"
But of course she knew what he meant.
"Red sheets, I think."
"I can't believe you told me that."
"You asked Francesca Stirling."
He looked down at her, and one lock of midnight black hair fell onto his forehead.
"You're just lucky I don't tell your husband on you."
"John would never worry over me," she said.
For a moment, she didn't think he would reply, but then he said,
"I know."
And his voice was oddly grave and serious.
"It's the only reason I tease you."
She'd been watching the pavement, looking for rough spots. But his tone was so serious, she had to look up.
"You're the only woman I know who would never stray,"
he said, touching her chin.
"You have no idea how much I admire you for that."
"I love your cousin,"
she whispered.
"I would never betray him."
He brought his hand back to his side.
"I know."
He looked so handsome in the moonlight, and so unbearably in need of love, that her heart nearly broke. Surely there was no woman who could resist him, not with that perfect face and tall, muscular body. And anyone who took the time to explore what was underneath would come to know him as she did, as a kind-hearted man, loyal and true. With a hint of the devil, of course, but Francesca supposed that was what would attract the ladies in the first place. "Shall we?" Michael said, suddenly all charm. He tilted his head back in the direction of home, and she sighed and turned around.
"Thank you for taking me out,"
she said, after a few minutes of companionable silence.
"I wasn't exaggerating when I said I was going mad with the rain."
"You didn't say that,"
he said, immediately giving himself a mental kick. She'd said that she'd been feeling a bit odd, not that she'd been going mad, but only an idiot savant or a lovesick fool would have noticed the difference.
"Didn't I?"
She scrunched her brow together.
"Well, I was certainly thinking it. I've been rather sluggish, if you must know. The fresh air did me a great deal of good."
"Then I'm happy to have helped,"
he said gallantly. She smiled as they ascended the front steps to Kilmartin House. The door opened as their feet touched the top stair. The butler must have been watching for them. And then Michael waited, as Francesca was divested of her cloak in the front hall.
"Will you stay for another drink? Or must you leave immediately for your appointment?"
she inquired, her eyes glinting with the devil. He glanced at the clock at the end of the hall. It was 8:30, and while he had no place to be, there was no lady waiting for him, although he could certainly find one at the drop of a hat. And he rather thought he would. He didn't much feel like remaining here at Kilmartin House.
"I must go," he said. "I've much to do."
"You've nothing to do, and you know it,"
she said.
"You just wish to be wicked."
"It's an admirable pastime,"
he murmured. She opened her mouth to offer a retort. But just then, Simons, John's recently hired valet, came down the stairs.
"My lady,"
he inquired. Francesca turned to him and inclined her head, indicating that he should proceed.
"I've rapped on his lordship's door and called his name, twice, but he seems to be sleeping quite soundly. Do you still wish me to wake him?"
Francesca nodded.
"Yes, I'd love to let him sleep. He's been working so hard lately."
She directed this last bit at Michael.
"But I know that this meeting with Lord Liverpool is very important. You should... No, wait. I'll rouse him myself. It will be better that way."
She turned to Michael.
"I shall see you tomorrow."
"Actually, if John hasn't yet left, I'll wait,"
he
he replied. "I came on foot, so I might as well avail myself of his carriage once he's done with it." She nodded and hurried up the stairs, leaving Michael with nothing to do but hum under his breath as he idly examined the paintings in the hall. And then she screamed. Michael had no recollection of running up the stairs, but somehow there he was, in John's and Francesca's bedchamber, the one room in the house he never invaded. "Francesca!" he gasped. "Franny! Franny, what is—" She was sitting next to the bed, clutching John's forearm, which was dangling over the side.
"Wake him up, Michael!" she cried. "Wake him up! Do it for me! Wake him up!"
Michael felt his world slip away. The bed was across the room, a good 12 feet away. But he knew. No one knew John as well as he did. No one. And John wasn't there in the room. He was gone. What was on the bed? It wasn't John. "Francesca," he whispered, moving slowly toward her. His limbs felt strange and funny, and gruesomely sluggish. "Francesca." She looked up at him with huge, stricken eyes.
"Wake him up, Michael."
"Francesca, I—"
"No!"
she screamed, launching herself at him.
"Wake him up! You can do it! Wake him up! Wake him up!"
And all he could do was stand there as she beat her fists against his chest, stand there as she grabbed his cravat and shook and yanked until he was gasping for breath. He couldn't even embrace her, couldn't offer her comfort, because he was every bit as devastated and confused. And then suddenly the fire left her, and she collapsed in his arms, her tears soaking his shirt.
"He had a headache," she whimpered. "That's all. He just had a headache. It was just a headache."
She looked up at him, her eyes searching his face, looking for answers he'd never be able to give her.
"It was just a headache,"
she said again, and she looked broken.
"I know,"
he said, even though he knew it wasn't enough.
"Oh, Michael,"
she sobbed.
"What am I to do?"
"I don't know,"
he said, because he didn't. Between Eton, Cambridge, and the army, he'd been trained for everything that the life of an English gentleman was supposed to offer. But he hadn't been trained for this.
"I don't understand,"
she was saying, and he supposed she was saying a lot of things, but none of it made any sense to his ears. He didn't even have the strength to stand, and together the two of them sank to the carpet, leaning against the side of the bed. He stared sightlessly at the far wall, wondering why he wasn't crying. He was numb, and his body felt heavy, and he couldn't shake the feeling that his very soul had been ripped from his body. Not John. Why? Why? And as he sat there, dimly aware of the servants gathering just outside the open door, it occurred to him that Francesca was whimpering those very same words.
"Not John. Why? Why?"
"Do you think she might be with child?"
Michael stared at Lord Winston, a new and apparently over-eager appointee to the Committee for Privileges of the House of Lords, trying to make sense of his words. John had been dead barely a day. It was still hard to make sense of anything. And now, here was this puffy little man, demanding an audience, prattling on about some sacred duty to the crown.
"Her ladyship," Lord Winston said. "If she's carrying, it will complicate everything."
"I don't know," Michael said. "I didn't ask her."
"You need to. I'm sure you're eager to assume control of your new holdings, but we really must determine if she's carrying. Furthermore, if she is pregnant, a member of our committee will need to be present at the birth."
Michael felt his face go slack.
"I beg your pardon,"
he somehow managed to say.
"Baby switching," Lord Winston said grimly. "There have been instances—"
"For God's sake!"
"'It's for your protection as much as anyone's,'
Lord Winston cut in.
"'If her ladyship gives birth to a girl, and there is no one present to witness it, "'what is to stop her from switching the babe with a boy?'
Michael couldn't even bring himself to dignify this with an answer.
"'You need to find out if she is carrying,'
Lord Winston pressed.
"'Arrangements will need to be made.'
"'She was widowed yesterday,'
Michael said sharply. "'I will not burden her with such intrusive questions.'
"'There is more at stake here than her ladyship's feelings,'
Lord Winston returned.
"'We cannot properly transfer the earldom while there is doubt as to the succession.'
"'The devil take the earldom!'
Michael snapped. Lord Winston gasped, drawing back in visible horror.
"'You forget yourself, my lord.'
"'I'm not your lord,'
Michael bit off.
"'I'm not anyone's.'
He halted his words, sinking into a chair, trying very hard to get past the fact that he was perilously close to tears. Right here in John's study, with this damnable little man who didn't seem to understand that a man had died. Not just an earl, but a man. Michael wanted to cry. And he would, he suspected. As soon as Lord Winston left, and Michael could lock the door and make sure that no one could see him, he would probably bury his face in his hands and cry.
"'Someone has to ask her,'
Lord Winston said.
"'It won't be me,'
Michael said in a low voice.
"'I will do it, then.'
Michael leapt from his seat and pinned Lord Winston against the wall.
"'You will not approach Lady Kilmartin,' he growled. "'You will not even breathe the same air. "'Do I make myself clear?'
"'Quite,'
the smaller man gurgled. "'Michael let go, dimly aware that Lord Winston's face was beginning to turn purple.
"'Get out,'
he said.
"'You will need...
"'Get out!'
he roared.
"'I will come back tomorrow,'
Lord Winston said, skittering out the door.
"'We will speak when you are in a calmer frame of mind.'
Michael leaned against the wall, staring at the open doorway. Good God, how had it all come to this? John hadn't even been 30. He was the picture of health. Michael might have been second in line for the earldom as long as John and Francesca's marriage remained childless, but no one had truly thought he'd ever inherit. Already he'd heard that men in the clubs were calling him the luckiest man in Britain. Overnight, he'd gone from the fringe of aristocracy to its very epicentre. No one seemed to understand that Michael had never wanted this, never. He didn't want an earldom. He wanted his cousin back. And no one seemed to understand that. Except, perhaps, Francesca. But she was so wrapped in her own grief that she could not quite comprehend the pain in Michael's heart. And he would never ask her to. Not when she was so wrecked by her own. Michael wrapped his arms against his chest as he thought of her. For the rest of his life, he would not forget the sight of Francesca's face once the truth had finally sunk in. John was not sleeping. He was not going to wake up. And Francesca Bridgerton Stirling was, at the tender age of 22, the saddest thing imaginable. Alone. Michael understood her despair better than anyone could ever imagine. They'd put her to bed that night, he and her mother, who had hurried over at Michael's urgent summons, and she'd slept like a baby, with nary even a whimper, her body worn out from the shock of it all. But when she'd awakened the next morning, she'd acquired the proverbial stiff upper lip, determined to remain strong and steadfast, handling the myriad details that had showered down upon the house at John's death. The problem was, neither one of them had a clue what those details were. They were young. They had been carefree. They had never thought to deal with death. Who knew, for example, that the Committee for Privileges would get involved and demand a box seat at what ought to be a private moment for Francesca, if indeed she was even carrying? But bloody hell, he wasn't going to ask her. "'We need to tell his mother,' Francesca had said earlier that morning. It was the first thing she'd said, actually. There was no preamble, no greeting, just, "We need to tell his mother." Michael had nodded, since of course she was right. "We need to tell your mother, too. They're both in Scotland. They won't know yet." He nodded again. It was all he could manage. "I'll write the notes." And he nodded a third time, wondering what he was supposed to do. That question had been answered when Lord Winston had come to call. But Michael couldn't bear to think about all that now. It seemed so distasteful. He didn't want to think of all he would gain at John's death. How could anyone possibly speak as if something good had come of all this? Michael felt himself sinking down, down, sliding against the wall, until he was sitting on the floor, his legs bent in front of him, his head resting on his knees. He hadn't wanted this, had he? He'd wanted Francesca, that was all. But not like this, not at this cost. He'd never begrudged John his good fortune. He'd never coveted the title, the money, or the power. He'd merely coveted his wife. Now he was meant to assume John's title, step into his shoes, and guilt was squeezing its merciless fist right around his heart. Had he somehow wished for this? No, he couldn't have. He hadn't. Had he? "Michael?" He looked up. It was Francesca, still wearing that hollow look, her face a blank mask that tore at his heart far more than her wailing sorrow ever could have done. "I sent for Janet." He nodded. John's mother. She would be devastated. "And your mother as well." She would be equally bereft. "Is there anyone else you think..." He shook his head, aware that he should get up, aware that propriety dictated that he rise. But he just couldn't find the strength. He didn't want Francesca to see him so weak, but he couldn't help it.
"You should sit down," he finally said. "You need to rest."
"I can't," she said. "I need to... If I stop, even for a moment, I will..." Her words trailed off. But it didn't matter. He understood. He looked up at her. Her chestnut hair was pulled back into a simple queue, and her face was pale. She looked young, barely out of the schoolroom. Certainly too young for this sort of heartbreak.
"Francesca," he said.
His word not quite a question. More of a sigh, really. And then she said it. She said it without his having to ask. "I'm pregnant."
Chapter 3.
"I love him madly, madly. Truly, I would die without him."
From the Countess of Kilmartin to her sister, Eloise Bridgerton, 1 week after Francesca's wedding.
"I declare, Francesca, you are the healthiest expectant mother I have ever laid eyes upon."
Francesca smiled at her mother-in-law, who had just entered the garden of the St. James's mansion they now shared. Overnight, it seemed, Kilmartin House had become a household of women. First, Janet had taken up residence, and then Helen, Michael's mother. It was a house full of sterling females, or at least those who had acquired the name in marriage. And it all felt so different. It was strange. She would have thought that she'd sense John's presence, feel him in the air, see him in the surroundings they'd shared for 2 years. But instead, he was simply gone. And the influx of women had changed the tone of the house entirely. Francesca supposed that was a good thing. She needed the support of women right now. But it was odd, living among women. There were more flowers now, vases everywhere, it seemed. And there was no longer any lingering smell of John's cheroot or the sandalwood soap he'd favoured. Kilmartin House now smelled of lavender and rosewater, and every whiff of it broke Francesca's heart. Even Michael had been strangely distant. Oh, he came to call. several times a week, if one cared to count, which Francesca had to admit she did. But he wasn't there, not in the way he had been before John's death. He wasn't the same, and she supposed she ought not to castigate him for that, even if only in her mind. He was hurting too. She knew that. She reminded herself of it when she saw him, and his eyes were distant. She reminded herself of it when she didn't know what to say to him, and when he didn't tease her. And she reminded herself of it when they sat together in the drawing room and had nothing to say. She'd lost John, and now it seemed she'd lost Michael too. And even with two mother hens fussing over her, three, if she counted her own, who came to call every single day, she was so lonely and sad. No one had ever told her how sad she'd be. Who would have thought to tell her? And even if someone had, even if her mother, who had also been widowed young, had explained the pain, how could she have understood? It was one of those things that had to be experienced to be understood. And oh, how Francesca wished she didn't belong to this melancholy club. And where was Michael? Why couldn't he comfort her? Why didn't he realize how very much she needed him? Him, not his mother, not anyone's mother. She needed Michael, the one person who had known John the way she had, the only person who had loved him as fully. Michael was her one link to the husband she had lost, and she hated him for staying away. Even when he was here, at Kilmartin House, in the same dashed room as her, it wasn't the same. They didn't joke, and they didn't tease. They just sat there, and looked sad and grief-stricken, and when they spoke, there was an awkwardness that had never been there before. Couldn't anything remain as it was before John had died? It had never occurred to her that her friendship with Michael might be killed off as well. "How are you feeling, dear?" Francesca looked up at Janet, belatedly realizing that her mother-in-law had asked her a question. Several, probably, and she'd forgotten to answer, lost in her own thoughts. She did that a lot lately. "Fine," she said. "No different than I ever have done." Janet shook her head in wonder. "It's remarkable. I've never heard of such a thing." Francesca shrugged. "If it weren't for the loss of my courses, I'd never know anything was different." And it was true. She wasn't sick. She wasn't hungry. She wasn't anything. A trifle more tired than usual, she supposed. But that could be the grief as well. Her mother had told her that she'd been tired for a year after her father had died. Of course, her mother had had 8 children to look after. Francesca just had herself, with a small army of servants treating her like an invalid queen. "You're very fortunate," Janet said, sitting down on the chair opposite Francesca's. "When I was carrying John, I was sick every single morning, and most afternoons as well." Francesca nodded and smiled. Janet had told this to her before, several times. John's death had turned his mother into a magpie, constantly chattering on, trying to fill the silence that was Francesca's grief. Francesca adored her for it, for trying, but she suspected the only thing that would assuage her pain was time.
"I'm so pleased you're carrying," Janet said, leaning forward and impulsively squeezing Francesca's hand. "It makes it all a bit more bearable. Or, I suppose, a bit less unbearable," she added, not really smiling, but looking like she was trying to.
Francesca just nodded, afraid that speaking would loosen the tears in her eyes.
"I'd always wanted more children," Janet confessed, "but it wasn't to be. And when John died, well, let's just say that no grandchild shall ever be loved more than the one you're carrying."
She stopped, pretending to dab her handkerchief against her nose, but really aiming for her eyes.
"Don't tell anyone, but I don't care whether it's a boy or a girl. It's a piece of him. That's all that matters."
"I know," Francesca said softly, placing her hand on her belly. She wished there was some sign of the baby within. She knew it was too soon to feel movement. She wasn't even 3 months along, by her carefully calculated estimation. But all her dresses still fit perfectly, and her food still tasted just as it always had. And she simply wasn't experiencing any of the quirks and illnesses that other women had told her about. She'd have been happy to have been casting up her accounts each morning, if only so that she could imagine the baby was waving its hand with a cheerful, "I'm here."
"Have you seen Michael recently?" Janet asked. "Not since Monday," Francesca said. "He doesn't come to call very often any more."
"He misses John," Janet said softly.
"So do I,"
Francesca replied, and she was horrified by the sharp edge to her voice.
"It must be very difficult for him,"
Janet mused. Francesca just stared at her, her lips parting with surprise.
"I do not mean to say it is not difficult for you, too,"
Janet said quickly.
"But think of the tenuousness of his position. He won't know if he's to be the Earl for 6 more months. There is nothing I can do about that."
"No, of course not," Janet assured her.
"But it does put him in awkward straits. I've heard more than one matron say that they simply can't consider him as a potential suitor for their daughters until and unless you give birth to a girl. It's one thing to marry the Earl of Kilmartin. It's quite another when it's his impoverished cousin, and no one knows which he will be."
"Michael isn't impoverished," Francesca said peevishly. "And besides, he would never marry while in mourning for John."
"No, I suppose not. But I do hope he starts looking," Janet said. "I do so want him to be happy. And, of course, if he is to be the Earl, he shall have to beget an heir. Otherwise the title shall go to that awful Debenham side of the family."
Janet shuddered at the thought.
"Michael will do what he must,"
Francesca said, although she wasn't so sure. It was difficult to imagine him marrying. It had always been difficult. Michael wasn't the sort to stay true to any woman for very long, but now it just seemed strange. For years she had had John, and Michael had been their companion. Could she bear it if he married, and then she was the third wheel? Was her heart big enough to be happy for him while she was alone? She rubbed her eyes. She felt very tired, and, in truth, a bit weak. A good sign, she supposed. She'd heard that pregnant women were supposed to be more tired than she usually was. She looked over at Janet.
"I think I shall go upstairs and take a nap."
"An excellent idea," Janet said approvingly. "You need your rest." Francesca nodded and stood, then grabbed the arm of the chair to steady herself when she swayed.
"I don't know what is wrong with me," she said, attempting a wobbly smile. "I feel very unsteady. I..."
Janet's gasp cut her off.
"Janet?"
Francesca looked at her mother-in-law with concern. She'd gone quite pale, and one shaking hand rose to meet her lips.
"What is it?"
Francesca asked, and then she realized that Janet wasn't looking at her. She was looking at her chair. With slowly dawning horror, Francesca looked down, forcing herself to look at the seat she'd just vacated. There, in the middle of the cushion, was a small patch of red. Blood. Life would have been easier, Michael thought wryly, if he'd been given to drink. If ever there was a time to overindulge, to drown one's sorrows in the bottle, this was it. But no. He'd been cursed with a robust constitution and a marvellous ability to hold his liquor with dignity and flair, which meant that if he wanted to reach any sort of mind-numbing oblivion, he'd have to down the entire bottle of whiskey sitting on his desk, and maybe even then some. He looked out the window. It wasn't yet dark. Even he, dissolute rake that he tried to be, couldn't bring himself to drink an entire bottle of whiskey before the sun went down. Michael tapped his fingers against his desk, wishing he knew what to do with himself. John had been dead for 6 weeks now,
but he was still living in his modest apartments in the Albany. He couldn't quite bring himself to take up residence in Kilmartin House. It was the residence of the Earl, and that wouldn't be him for at least another 6 months, or maybe not ever. According to Lord Winston, whose lectures Michael had eventually been forced to tolerate, the title would go into abeyance until Francesca delivered, and if she gave birth to a boy, Michael would remain in the same position he'd always been in, cousin to the Earl. But it wasn't Michael's peculiar situation that was keeping him away. He'd have been reticent to move into Kilmartin House, even if Francesca hadn't been pregnant. She was still there. She was still there, and she was still the Countess of Kilmartin. And even if he was the Earl, with no questions attached to the title, she wouldn't be his Countess, and he just didn't know if he could take the irony of it. He'd thought that his grief might finally overtake his longing for her, that he might finally be with her and not want her. But no, his breath still caught every time she walked into the room, and his body tightened when she brushed past him, and his heart still ached with the pain of loving her. Except now it was all wrapped in an extra layer of guilt, as if he hadn't had enough of that while John was alive. She was in pain, and she was grieving, and he ought to be comforting her, not lusting after her. Good God, John wasn't even cold in his grave. What kind of monster would lust after his wife? His pregnant wife? He was already stepping into John's shoes in so many ways. He would not complete the betrayal by taking his place with Francesca as well. And so he stayed away. Not completely. That would have been too obvious. And besides, he couldn't do that. Not with his mother and John's in residence at Kilmartin House. Plus, everyone was looking to him to manage the affairs of the Earl, even though the title wasn't potentially to be his for another 6 months. He did it, though. He didn't mind the details. Didn't care that he was spending several hours per day looking after a fortune that might go to another. It was the least he could do for John, and for Francesca. He couldn't bring himself to be a friend to her, not the way he ought, but he could make sure that her financial affairs were in order. But he knew she didn't understand. She often came to visit him while he was working in John's study at Kilmartin House, poring over reports from various land stewards and solicitors, and he could tell that she was looking for their old camaraderie. But he just couldn't do it. Call him weak, call him shallow, but he just couldn't be her friend. Not just yet, anyway.
Mr. Stirling?
Michael looked up. His valet was at the door, accompanied by a footman, dressed in the unmistakable green and gold livery of Kilmartin House.
A message for you,
the footman said.
From your mother.
Michael held out his hand as the footman crossed the room, wondering what it was this time. His mother summoned him to Kilmartin House every other day, it seemed.
She said it was urgent,
the footman added, as he placed the envelope in Michael's hand. Urgent, eh? That was new. Michael glanced up at the footman and valet, his steady gaze a clear dismissal, and then, once the room had been emptied, slid his letter opener under the flap.
"Come quickly," was all it said. "Francesca has lost the baby."
Michael nearly killed himself rushing to Kilmartin House, racing on horseback at a breakneck pace, ignoring the shouts from the angry pedestrians he'd nearly decapitated in his haste. But now that he was here, standing in the hall, he had no idea what to do with himself. Miscarriage? It seemed such a womanly thing. What was he meant to do? It was a tragedy, and he felt horrible for Francesca. But what did they think he could say? Why did they want him here? And then it hit him. He was the Earl now. It was done. Slowly but surely, he was assuming John's life, filling every corner of the world that had once belonged to his cousin.
Oh, Michael!
His mother said, rushing into the hall.
I'm so glad you're here.
He embraced her, his arms awkwardly coming around her, and he said something utterly meaningless like, "Such a tragedy." But mostly he just stood there, feeling foolish and out of place.
"How is she?"
he finally asked, once his mother stepped back.
"In shock,"
she replied. "She's been crying." He swallowed, wanting desperately to loosen his cravat.
"Well, that's to be expected," he said. I...
"She can't seem to stop," Helen interrupted.
"Crying?"
Michael asked. Helen nodded. "I don't know what to do." Michael measured his breaths. Even. Slow. In and out. "Michael?" His mother was looking up to him for a response. Maybe for guidance. As if he would know what to do.
"Her mother came by,"
Helen said, when it became apparent that Michael was not going to speak.
"She wants Francesca to go back to Bridgerton House."
"Does Francesca want to?"
Helen shrugged sadly.
"I don't think she knows. It's all such a shock."
"Yes,"
Michael said, swallowing again. He didn't want to be here. He wanted to get out.
"The doctor said we're not to move her for several days in any case," Helen added.
He nodded. "Naturally, we called for you." Naturally? There was nothing natural about it. He'd never felt so out of place, so completely at a loss for words or action.
"You're Kilmartin now,"
his mother said quietly. He nodded again. Just once. It was as much of an acknowledgement as he could muster.
"I must say, I..."
Helen stopped, her lips pursing in an odd, jerky manner.
"Well, a mother wants the world for her children, but I didn't... I never would have..."
"Don't say it,"
Michael said hoarsely. He wasn't ready for anyone to say this was a good thing. And by God, if anyone offered his congratulations, well, he wouldn't be responsible for the violence.
"She asked for you,"
his mother said.
"Francesca?"
he asked, his eyes flying open with surprise. Helen nodded. "She said she wanted you."
"I can't,"
he said. "You have to."
"I can't."
He shook his head, panic making his movements too quick.
"I can't go in there."
"You can't abandon her,"
his mother said.
"She was never mine to abandon."
"Michael!"
Helen gasped.
"How can you say such a thing?"
"Mother,"
he said, desperately trying to redirect the conversation.
"She needs a woman. What can I do?"
"You can be her friend,"
Helen said softly, and he felt eight again, scolded for a thoughtless transgression.
"No,"
he said, and his voice horrified him. He sounded like a wounded animal, pained and confused. But there was one thing he knew for certain. He couldn't see her. Not now. Not yet.
"Michael,"
his mother said.
"No,"
he said again.
"I will... tomorrow. I'll..."
And he strode for the door with nothing more than a...
"Give her my best."
And then he fled. Coward that he was.
Chapter 4.
I am sure it is not worth such high drama. I do not profess to know or understand romantic love between husband and wife, but surely it is not so all-encompassing that the loss of one would destroy the other. You are stronger than you think, dear sister. You would survive quite handily without him, moot point though it may be.
From Eloise Bridgerton to her sister, the Countess of Kilmartin, 3 weeks after Francesca's wedding. The following month was, Michael was certain, the best approximation of hell on earth that any human being was likely to experience. With every new ceremony, each and every document he found himself signing as Kilmartin, or My Lord, he was forced to endure, it was as if John's spirit was being pushed farther away. Soon, Michael thought dispassionately,
It would be as if he'd never existed. Even the baby, who was to have been the last piece of John Sterling left on earth, was gone. And everything that had been John's was now Michael's. Except Francesca. And Michael intended to keep it that way. He would not, no, he could not offer his cousin that last insult. He'd had to see her, of course, and he'd offered his best words of comfort. But whatever he'd said, it wasn't the right thing, and she'd just turned her head and looked at the wall. He didn't know what to say. Frankly, he was more relieved that she was not injured than he was upset that the baby had been lost. The mothers, his, John's, and Francesca's, had felt compelled to describe the gore to him in appalling detail, and one of the maids had even trotted out the bloody sheets, which someone had saved to offer as proof that Francesca had miscarried. Lord Winston had nodded approvingly, but had then added that he would have to keep an eye on the Countess just to be sure that the sheets were truly hers and that she wasn't actually increasing. This wouldn't be the first time someone had tried to circumvent the sacred laws of primogeniture, he'd added. Michael had wanted to hurl the yappy little man out the window, but instead he'd merely shown him the door. He no longer had energy for that kind of anger, it seemed. He still hadn't moved into Kilmartin House. He wasn't quite ready for it, and the thought of living there with all those women was suffocating. He'd have to do so soon, he knew. It was expected of the Earl. But for now, he was content enough in his small suite of apartments. And that was where he was, avoiding his duties, when Francesca finally sought him out. "Michael," she said, once his valet had shown her to his small sitting-room.
"Francesca,"
he replied, shocked at her appearance. She'd never come here before, not when John had been alive, and certainly not after.
"What are you doing here?"
"I wanted to see you," she said,
the unspoken message being, "You're avoiding me." It was the truth, of course, but all he said was,
"Sit down."
And then belatedly, "Please."
Was this improper,
her being here in his apartments? He wasn't sure. The circumstances of their position were so odd, so completely out of order, that he had no idea which rules of etiquette were currently governing them. She sat, and did nothing but fiddle her fingers against her skirts for a full minute, and then she looked up at him, her eyes meeting his with heartbreaking intensity, and said,
"I miss you."
The walls began to close in around him.
"Francesca, I..."
"You were my friend," she said accusingly. "Besides John, you were my closest friend, and I don't know who you are any longer."
"I..."
Oh, he felt like a fool. Utterly impotent and brought down by a pair of blue eyes and a mountain of guilt. Guilt for what? He wasn't even certain any longer. It seemed to come from so many sources, from such a variety of directions, that he couldn't quite keep track of it.
"What is wrong with you?" she asked. "Why do you avoid me?"
"I don't know,"
he replied, since he couldn't lie to her and say that he wasn't. She was too smart for that. But neither could he tell her the truth. Her lips quivered, and then the lower one caught between her teeth. He stared at it, unable to take his eyes off her mouth, hating himself for the rush of longing that swept over him.
"You were supposed to be my friend too," she whispered.
"Francesca, don't."
"I needed you," she said softly. "I still do."
"No, you don't," he replied. "You have the mothers, and all your sisters as well."
"I don't want to talk to my sisters," she said, her voice growing impassioned. "They don't understand."
"Well, I certainly don't understand,"
he shot back, desperation lending an unpleasant edge to his voice. She just stared at him, condemnation colouring her eyes.
"Francesca, you..."
He wanted to throw up his arms.
but instead he just crossed them.
You miscarried.
I am aware of that, she said tightly.
What do I know of such things? You need to talk to a woman.
Can't you say you're sorry?
I did say I was sorry.
Can't you mean it? What did she want from him?
Francesca, I did mean it.
I'm just so angry, she said, her voice rising in intensity. And I'm sad, and I'm upset, and I look at you and I don't understand why you're not. For a moment he didn't move.
Don't you ever say that, he whispered.
Her eyes flashed with anger.
Well, you've a funny way of showing it. You never call, and you never speak to me, and you don't understand.
What do you want me to understand?
He burst out.
What can I understand? For the love of...
He stopped himself before he blasphemed and turned away from her, leaning heavily on the windowsill. Behind him, Francesca just sat quietly, still as death. And then, finally, she said,
I don't know why I came. I'll go.
Don't go,
he said hoarsely, but he didn't turn around. She said nothing. She wasn't sure what he meant.
You only just arrived,
he said, his voice halting and awkward.
You should have a cup of tea at least.
Francesca nodded, even though he still wasn't looking at her. And they remained thus for several minutes, for far too long, until she could not bear the silence any longer. The clock ticked in the corner, and her only company was Michael's back, and all she could do was sit there and think and think and wonder why she'd come here. What did she want from him? And wouldn't her life be easier if she actually knew?
Michael,
she said, his name leaving her lips before she realized it. He turned around. He didn't speak, but he acknowledged her with his eyes. Why had she called out to him? What did she want? Still he didn't speak, just stood there and waited for her to collect her thoughts, which made everything so much harder. And then, to her horror, it spilled out.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do now, she said, hearing her voice break. And I'm so angry, and...
She stopped, gasped, anything to halt the tears. Across from her, Michael opened his mouth, but only barely, and even then nothing came out.
I don't know why this is happening, she whimpered. What did I do? What did I ever do?
Nothing, he assured her.
He's gone, and he isn't coming back, and I'm so, so...
She looked up at him, feeling the grief and the anger etching themselves into her face.
It isn't fair. It isn't fair that it's me and not someone else. And it isn't fair that it should be anyone. And it isn't fair that I lost them.
And then she choked, and the gasps became sobs, and all she could do was cry.
Francesca, Michael said, kneeling at her feet. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
I know, she sobbed. But it doesn't make it better.
No,
he murmured.
And it doesn't make it fair.
No,
he said again.
And it doesn't. It doesn't.
He didn't try to finish the sentence for her. She wished he had. For years she wished he had, because maybe then he would have said the wrong thing. And maybe then she wouldn't have leaned into him. And maybe then she wouldn't have allowed him to hold her. But, oh, God, how she missed being held.
Why did you go?
She cried.
Why can't you help me?
I want to. You don't...
And then finally he just said,
I don't know what to say.
She was asking too much of him. She knew it, but she didn't care. She was just so sick of being alone. But right then, at least for a moment, she wasn't alone. Michael was there, and he was holding her, and she felt warm and safe for the first time in weeks, and she just cried.
She cried weeks of tears. She cried for John, and she cried for the baby she'd never know. But most of all, she cried for herself.
"Michael,"
she said, once she'd recovered enough to speak. Her voice was still shaky, but she managed his name, and she knew she was going to have to manage more.
"Yes."
"We can't go on like this."
She felt something change in him. His embrace tightened. Or maybe it loosened, but something was not quite the same.
"Like what?"
he asked, his voice hoarse and hesitant. She drew back so she could see him, relieved when his arms fell away and she didn't have to wriggle free.
"Like this,"
she said, even though she knew he didn't understand. Or if he did, that he was going to pretend otherwise.
"With you ignoring me,"
she continued.
"Francesca, I..."
"The baby was to have been yours in a way, too,"
she blurted out. He went pale, deathly pale. So much so that for a moment she couldn't breathe.
"What do you mean?"
he whispered.
"It would have needed a father,"
she said, shrugging helplessly.
"I... you... it would have had to be you."
"You have brothers,"
he choked out.
"They didn't know, John. Not the way you did."
He moved away, stood, and then, as if that weren't enough, backed up as far as he could, all the way to the window. His eyes flared slightly, and for a moment she could have sworn that he resembled a trapped animal, cornered and terrified, waiting for the finality of the kill.
"Why are you telling me this?"
he said, his voice flat and low.
"I don't know,"
she said, swallowing uncomfortably. But she did know. She wanted him to grieve as she grieved. She wanted him to hurt in every way she hurt. It wasn't fair, and it wasn't nice, but she couldn't help it, and she didn't feel like apologizing for it either.
"Francesca,"
he said, and his tone was strange, hollow and sharp, and like nothing she'd ever heard. She looked at him, but she moved her head slowly, scared by what she might see in his face.
"I'm not John," he said.
"I know that."
"I'm not John,"
he said again, louder, and she wondered if he'd even heard her.
"I know."
His eyes narrowed and focused on her with dangerous intensity.
"It wasn't my baby, and I can't be what you need."
And inside of her, something started to die.
"Michael, I..."
"I won't take his place,"
he said, and he wasn't shouting, but it sounded like maybe he wanted to.
"No, you couldn't. You..."
And then, in a startling flash of motion, he was at her side, and he'd grabbed her shoulders and hauled her to her feet.
"I won't do it,"
he yelled, and he was shaking her, and then holding her still, and then shaking her again.
"I can't be him. I won't be him."
She couldn't speak, couldn't form words, didn't know what to do, didn't know who he was. He stopped shaking her, but his fingers bit into her shoulders as he stared down at her, his quicksilver eyes afire with something terrifying and sad.
"You can't ask this of me,"
he gasped.
"I can't do it."
"Michael,"
she whispered, hearing something awful in her voice, fear.
"Michael, please let me go."
He didn't, but she wasn't even sure he'd heard her. His eyes were lost, and he seemed beyond her, unreachable.
"Michael,"
she said again, and her voice was louder, panicked. And then, abruptly, he did as she asked, and he stumbled back, his face a portrait of self-loathing.
"I'm sorry,"
he whispered, staring at his hands as if they were foreign bodies.
"I'm so sorry."
Francesca edged toward the door.
"I'd better go,"
she said. He nodded.
"Yes.
I think..."
She stopped, choking on the word as she grasped the doorknob, clutching it like her salvation.
"I think we had better not see each other for a while."
He nodded jerkily.
"Maybe..."
But she didn't say anything more. She didn't know what to say. If she'd known what had just happened between them, she might have found some words. But for now, she was too bewildered and scared to figure it all out. Scared? But why? She certainly wasn't scared of him. Michael would never hurt her. He'd lay down his life for her if the opportunity forced itself. She was quite sure of that. Maybe she was just scared of tomorrow. And the day after that. She'd lost everything. And now it appeared she'd lost Michael as well. And she just wasn't sure how she was supposed to bear it all.
"I'm going to go," she said, giving him one last chance to stop her.
To say something. To say anything that might make it all go away. But he didn't. He didn't even nod. He just looked at her, his eyes silent in their agreement. And Francesca left. She walked out the door and out of his house, and then she climbed into her carriage and went home. And she didn't say a word. She climbed up her stairs, and she climbed into her bed. But she didn't cry. She kept thinking she should, kept feeling like she might like to. But all she did was stare at the ceiling. The ceiling, at least, didn't mind her regard. Back in his apartments in the Albany, Michael grabbed his bottle of whiskey and poured himself a tall glass, even though a glance at the clock revealed the day to be still younger than noon. He'd sunk to a new low. That much was clear. But try as he might, he couldn't figure out what else he could have done. It wasn't as if he'd meant to hurt her, and he certainly hadn't stopped, pondered, and decided, "Oh, yes, I do believe I shall act like an ass." But even though his reactions had been swift and unconsidered, he didn't see how he might have behaved any other way. He knew himself. He didn't always, or these days even often, like himself. But he knew himself. And when Francesca had turned to him with those bottomless blue eyes and said, "The baby was to have been yours in a way, too," she'd shattered him to his very soul. She didn't know. She had no idea. And as long as she remained in the dark about his feelings for her, as long as she couldn't understand why he had no choice but to hate himself for every step he took in John's shoes, he couldn't be near her. Because she was going to keep saying things like that, and he simply didn't know how much he could take. And so, as he stood in his study, his body taut with misery and guilt, he realized two things. The first was easy. The whiskey was doing nothing to ease his pain, and if 25-year-old whiskey, straight from Speyside, didn't make him feel any better, nothing in the British Isles was going to do so. Which led him to the second, which wasn't easy at all. But he had to do it. Rarely had the choices in his life been so clear. Painful, but painfully clear. And so he set down his glass, two fingers of the amber liquid remaining, and he walked down the hall to his bedchamber. "Rivers," he said, upon finding his valet standing at the wardrobe, carefully folding a cravat, "what do you think of India?"